Blog Talk Radio.
I would start the show off with that, a very familiar theme. If you guys don't recognize that, that is the Air Force theme. Happy Veterans Day, everybody. This is Mark, and you're listening to Somewhere in Vegas here on blogtalkradio.com. Hopefully within just a few minutes, we're going to have two very outstanding young ladies. Hillary Prittis and Mattia Carell. They are the producer and director, respectively, of the upcoming miniseries Fly Girls. It's very interesting to be able to talk to them a little bit about what's been going on in terms of their project, which is really great. Talking about the unsung heroes of World War II, those are the female pilots. Many of them don't realize that 38 had died as pilots for the Air Force at that time, during wartime. And a lot of these girls haven't been recognized, and it's great for these two to have gotten that opportunity to be able to be a part of telling these ladies' stories. So hopefully they'll be showing us momentarily. And hopefully in a bit we're also going to have a throwback interview from 8 years ago. We're going to we'll have the interview with Chef Carrie Simon, who is one of the first rock and roll chefs. He was one of the early stars on Food Network. He was an Iron Chef at one point. And sorry to say, he lost his battle with multiple system atrophy about a month ago. And we'll have that interview later on in the show. For right now, we will give our first guests up. I'm very proud to have the very fine young ladies of the Fly Girls series. Is this both of you, Hillary and Mattia?
Yes, it is.
And I'm hoping I'm not butchering your name at all. Is it Mattia?
Yes, exactly, Mattia Carell.
Okay,
and great.
I just wanted to make sure I had that correct.
No, you did. Thank you for that.
Okay, yeah. Well, thanks for joining us, and obviously happy Veterans Day to you two. It was a really great opportunity and kind of really great timing to have you two on the show today as well. I mean, you know, what does it mean to you that to be able to tell some of these stories about these women in World War II and what they've done for the country at that time?
Well, to put it simply, it means everything. And to put it specifically and personally, it means a lot to a dear friend of mine, Violet Cowden, who was a WASP, who as they say, took her last flight in 2011. And I promised her that I would get this story told, and that's what we're trying to do. So giving us this opportunity that you're giving us now to get the word out, to get the story out, is everything. And there are stories of remarkable women, courageous and confident, with images of that we haven't seen, that we don't know of, that we're just unfamiliar with, or are ignorant of, in fact. I think their military history means everything to where we are now, with the women who are perhaps joining in the military, or the whole question of women in combat. So it's important to know what came before, so that it just didn't start in the last 10 years or 15, 20 years, that it started over 70 years ago. that women wanted to be part of making a contribution to this country.
Yeah, I was looking over the numbers before we got on air, and there's right now the Air Force is reporting 678 female pilots currently under their stead, which is unbelievable to say the least. It's still a smaller portion compared to their male counterparts, but 678 women that are currently pilots in the military in terms of the Air Force is just outstanding to be able to say that. And I think we've come a long way since then, since World War II and all that as well. And a lot of these girls are currently, combat ready as they were as well. So it's great to be able to see that they have those opportunities as well. Now you mentioned that obviously this is a very personal story to you, in terms of these young ladies. How was it to be able to interview some of these pilots from World War II and kind of have them recount what they've done in terms of their missions and what they've contributed to the country?
Well, it is nothing like it, actually. I mean, it's like they're living history. You know, it's what documentaries can't give us. It's what just even the images can't give us, that they're personal in their own words, how they felt, what they did. It's inspiring, and it's interesting. It gives an identity to myself, even though I'm not myself in the military. My mother was what they call a plane spotter in Boston, Massachusetts, during World War II when she was probably 18 or 19, which is how I first got interested in women's participation during World War II. And I think it helps give me a sense of my identity as a woman and the possibility and the idea that anything is possible, that what they did, what they've done at a time when women weren't allowed to even drive, that they were flying planes, it gives you the courage and the sense that you can try for everything. You can try for the stars. And I think that's what Violet Cowden, who inspired me, that was their message. The message is that a young girl could grow up to become anything she wanted to be. Because during that time, as you may well know, that the only choice they had was to be either a nurse or a hairdresser. So the war came along and it opened up this opportunity, this adventure for them. And it gave them a sense of what they could do. They gave them a sense of who they could be. And then after the war, they sort of asked them all to go home again, unfortunately. And so you just see these women as individuals, and at a time when they were trying, perhaps the women's lives were narrowly defined, and yet they broke those barriers. And they did what they did much more than what was expected of them.
Yeah, and I'll just add, this is Hillary, the producer, talking. I'll just add that on a day like today, when we're celebrating our veterans, it's so important that images of women in uniform are also a part of the imagery that's put out there. I'll just say, I think you just said there are 677 female pilots in the Air Force right now, and not to diminish that, but there were 1,074 women Air Force service pilots, and that was out of 25,000 applicants. So if you can imagine, in this country during World War II, 25,000 women applied, and not only were they applying to be women Air Force service pilots, they were flying. You had to have, your pilot's license and lots of hours to even qualify. So it's quite remarkable, and that imagery and that story has been lost until now, and that's the point of Fly Girls. The point of Fly Girls is to bring that story to the forefront of everybody's minds. I mean, as a young girl growing up, I did not think of women in the military. So I just wanted to add that.
Yeah, about you know, do you, well, roughly, I mean, did any of these ladies, you know, kind of, you know, still end up flying after the war in terms of just doing it privately? Obviously, they, you said that they were asked to go basically go home, but has any of them you know, still kind of went out on their own and still did some piloting on their own?
Yes, they did, but as you say, it could only be private. They weren't allowed to fly for an airline. You know, they were asked to maybe sell airline tickets, but they couldn't continue their career as a pilot. For instance, Violet, a lot of times, well, this is not flying, but when she was in her 80s, she decided to parachute out of an airplane because she had never done that before. So it really is it's a very unique and extraordinary kind of character we're talking about when we talk about these women. So I think in any case, if they could, they would certainly keep flying, but nothing on the scale of what they did in World War II.
Yeah, I mean, and you know, just to see how much there was accomplished even before World War II, I mean, obviously Amelia Earhart proved that you know, that women could you know, could basically conquer the world by flying. You know, it did take a while for us to do that as well. So it's kind of a shame that it took this long for them to gain a little bit more acceptance in terms of being you know, being able to pilot other forms of transportation and really kind of be accepted in terms of you know, of peacetime and even a little bit of wartime as well. So it's great to be able to see that we've made some progress on that as well. And I'd love to see more female pilots out there. I think that they've made strides through that as well. So I'm interested to see how that kind of goes. Yeah, I mean, and not to diminish what these girls did. I mean, you know, a lot of people think that, you know, oh, you know, they piloted planes from one place to another, but they were really dangerous. There were 38 women that died, you know, in the service of this as well. I mean, can you kind of elaborate on that?
Well, yes, I can. But just to go back to your point that they say, oh, they just ferried planes. Well, I have to tell you that 25 American women with Jackie Cochran went to the UK to fly with the ATA, the Air Transport Auxiliary, and so that they were in the thick of it. And this was to the women Air Force service pilots. So Hap Arnold, with Jackie Cochran, she took over 25 American women, and it was an experiment to make sure that these women could do what they, you know, that they could ferry planes or they could work together or whatever they thought they couldn't do. But they did it, and they did it in the UK, and they did it with Gower, who was the British woman, head of the women's division of the ATA. And only then were they then brought back to the United States, and then Jackie Cochran was allowed to create this really troop of as we say, over 1,000 women to ferry planes in the United States. And some of these women lost their lives in training. Some of these women lost their lives due to sabotage. Now, whether these saboteurs were either German sympathizers or just men who were unhappy to have women, thinking women were taking the place of men, or because the plane itself was faulty. You have to remember that these women went to different factories to pick up a plane that has never been flown before. So what they come out with is this little instruction booklet that says, okay, this is a new plane, this is how you fly it. And so they're the first ones to fly, and I can't remember the number of different planes, every kind of plane that was designed during that time these women flew. And I have to tell you that the generals, if men were balking flying something, what do? They put a woman pilot in there to show them that it could be done. And, of course, the women, knowing they had to be better than the men in order to keep themselves there, did. And so they flew the B-26.
And called the Black Widow. Which
is called, as Hillary's saying, which is called the Black Widow. And so if a woman could do it, certainly a man could do it. So They were guinea pigs, and they were also, during target practice, they were using live ammunition. So women pilots were flying the planes that the men on the ground were shooting at in order to practice their target shooting. So they were, you know, they were
in danger. Yeah, certainly in harm's way, especially when you consider that a lot of these people firing the guns at them weren't the best shots.
Right, they're training. And
yeah,
that's
go ahead.
I'm sorry, go ahead.
Oh, I was just going to mention that one person I was just, while I was listening, I was looking up something real quick. There's a gal that's named Opal Kuntz. I don't know if you're familiar with her. She helped train a lot of the Navy pilots during World War II as well. And I don't think she was part of the WASC Corps necessarily, but she helped train some of these pilots as well. So, yeah, they had more than just, you know, they did a lot more than a lot of people expected.
Exactly. And that's what they need to see. And that's what this mini-series will show, that it was much more complex, it was much more involved, and it was much more intricate. And it was a time in our country's history when and so much was changing, that the United States was becoming a superpower, and women who were in the WASP, of course, were not considered military. They didn't get military status until 35 years afterwards, and they never received benefits. So if someone died, like of those 38, they had to take up a collection among themselves, and Jackie Cochran, of course, was always very helpful with that. And then one of the women, the young women, had to, and then these women I'm talking about, it was like 20 and 21, 19, 20, 21, 22, and they had to then go accompany the coffin home, back to the hometown, to the parents. I mean, it was a phenomenal time for these young girls to grow up and become women that were now, who knew the world in a much bigger way than ever before.
Yeah, you know, I mean, and they got to, a lot of these girls got to see the world as it were. You know, some of these girls maybe had not had the opportunity to be able to even, you know, go out of their home state before being able to see the world. You know, some of these girls went all the way to Great Britain as well, and having that experience to be able to be a little bit more worldly and to be able to see the world as it is, you know, is an experience in itself.
Exactly. And as you just said, a lot of these young women never left their hometown. And then they go to New York to have an interview with Jackie Cochran. And some of these women were, like, underweight or 5'2", like Violet was, though, was and flew P-51 the Spitfires. I mean, they're phenomenal. And so she went to get her to get tested, and she was underweight. So the doctor sent her away and said, okay, go and eat bananas for the whole week, so you can come back and you can weigh enough and we can accept you, which is what she did. And I lost track of what your question was. I'm so sorry.
I was talking about them, you know, kind of being able to experience the world as it is, and being able to leave their hometowns and to be able to experience and meet other people from other places as well.
Exactly. So women of high society mixed with girls from the farm, mixed with Southern girls, mixed with girls from the they just got thrown in together. So there were six women to a bay, and I think it must have been an interesting, nerve-wracking probably opportunity, but probably an insightful one to meet women from all over the country that they weren't aware of, and that they could see themselves, their identity, differently with different women. And I think that must have been an incredible eye-opener for them, you know, so that their lives were less isolated and much more adventurous.
Now, you mentioned, you know, different backgrounds as well, and I remember from it correctly, you told me at one point that, in our conversations before this broadcast, that most of them were white females, but I think there was a Native American that actually ended up being a pilot. Is that correct?
That's correct, and also we had a couple of Chinese Americans who also were a part of it. And I have to say that the military did not allow African-American women to become part of the Women Air Force Service pilots. So what they did is they went to Tuskegee Air Force Base, and they flew with the men there. So there is an epic sort of landscape that we are investigating and writing about, so that it's not just a small group of women. It's really women all across this country who answered the call for their country.
Go ahead, Hillary.
I was just going to jump in that the scale of this story is quite epic, because not only did you have pilots like Janet Harmon Bragg, who was one of the first African-American women to have her pilot's license, if not the first, flying at Tuskegee, but you also had, before the U.S. entered the war, when the American women went to the ATA, there were women from 32 countries flying for the ATA, and they also had the Russian women pilots. They were called the Night Witches. They actually did fly in the Air Force for Russia. So it's quite an epic landscape at this time when the whole world was answering this call.
And what was the reaction, especially like overseas in Great Britain, of these ladies? And I mean, obviously there is probably a point at which, you know, they kind of were doubtful, but then of course they proved their muster, as it were, over there as well. But what was the consensus basically among a lot of the interviews about how people reacted at first and how they kind of gained respect over there?
Well, you know, I don't know that I can speak to the. I think the Brits, because they were obviously in the middle of it, that their appreciation for all these Spitfire women who came and to volunteer and to contribute their time, their efforts to the RAF through the ATA. I do know that in this country, of course, women got a lot more pushback. And, in fact, at the end of the war, because the men who were coming home felt that these women were taking their place, that they had to be disbanded. And they were just summarily disbanded without any big ceremony or parade even. You know, these women never got a parade. They never got what – they got it when they received the gold medal from in 2009 from President Obama. That was their day. And that's how many years after World War II, over 50 years after World War II. So I think there was confusion. I think men didn't know how to look at women who were, in a sense, equal to them and equal to what they were doing. And also, you get a group of women in a small town, and it can only mean bad things, you know. So they had this. They had to hide these women, so they wouldn't think that they were creating these houses of ill repute, or they said they were a baseball team, anything, so that socially and culturally people could get used to the idea that you could have a group of women who were there to do something good, to serve their country. That was not, we have to remember that was a really foreign idea that, yes, they could be nurses, they could be in the army, they could be secretaries, but the fact that they could be put on an equal level of a pilot, and believe me, I think if someone told these women that they had to go to combat, that they would have gone. I believe that. I believe that these women were that special. And they were only limited by the time by the times they lived in, not because of what they would want to do.
with that in mind, I want, you know, these, it seems like these ladies have kept in contact with each other, and they have been through a lot. They've been through a lot during battles and during wars, and obviously they gained really, really closeness with one another as well. How has it been in terms of after the war and these ladies keeping contact and always kind of knowing that they've been through the same stuff and to be very supportive of each other whenever through thick and thin or whatever was going on at that point? Can you tell us a little bit about the little sisterhood that was going on between these pilots?
Well, you know, it's amazing. Those 2.5 years for the women I'm speaking of, specifically the Women's Air Force Service pilots, it was everything to them. And, yes, they would have many meetings together. They'd go across the country and lecture on their service and what they did. I went to Sweetwater, Texas, when they dedicated the pond. This was a little outdoor pond that they had a ritual every time a woman passed her solo test that they would throw her in the pond. Okay, that was her celebration. And at that time, there were probably at least 500 women there. And it's amazing to see. It's amazing to see the camaraderie. I mean, it's there's nothing like it. There's certainly nothing like it before now where we have much more of an appreciation of women in the military. But to be in a room and it's visceral to feel that sisterhood, that idea that they were all there at the same time, I mean, same time period, was phenomenal. And what it gave me was a sense of my own identity as a woman, that I had different images to look up to.
I was going to go into that. I mean, obviously, I mean, you know, when you tell your story, and I'm really looking forward to when you do, some of these young girls are going to get inspired. I mean, a lot of these young girls got inspired to be able to get their pilot's license or to be able to serve their country. And know that they can conquer the world, to be able to do whatever they want right now. And especially right now in the past decade, we've seen a push for a lot of these young girls and these women that, you know, people keep on saying that, no, you can't do this, but they keep on proving everybody wrong. It's interesting to see, you know, back in during World War II, these girls were proving that they could pilot and they could pilot well against their male counterparts as well. So it's been interesting to say the least in terms of the aspect of them kind of inspiring a generation, the next couple generations.
That's exactly right. That at the time they were the future. I don't know that they knew it then because they tried to push it all back. They tried to make them all go away, but they were the future, and that's where we are now. And I think that's why it's so important to know that there is a history here, that there are roots to what women want to do, that their desires, their wishes to be independent and to fly and to reach the stars has always been there, you know, and for a very short while, these women proved that they could. I think bringing this story to light so that people see these images and see that it didn't happen in the last 25 years or the last 10 years. It happened over 70 years ago that women were calling out to do more. They wanted to contribute. They wanted to take part. That's why as we continue on to create our grassroots campaign, we are remaining independent. It's important to us in creating this mini-series that we do it with the complexity of the times that these women lived in. So we understand that they were fighting against their own society, their own culture. We can't sepia tone it. You know, we can't make it all rose-colored glasses because these women were complex. They were interesting. They were smart. And everything we're doing now with our crowdfunding campaign to raise money so that we can creatively keep it within our grasp so that we can say we know what this story is. We've been researching it for the last 20 years. We know these women. We have met these women. And we know that that so few people are aware of them, are aware that they've been with us a very, very long time. I mean, it's wonderful when we talk to them. I'm just going to say it's wonderful when we talk to their children or their grandchildren. They are so proud of their mothers or their aunts, or one woman told us even her nanny was a WASP. And these women are afraid that they have been forgotten. That's the sad part. That's why we're working so hard, because we can't forget that these women existed, that they were out there, that they lost their lives, that they put their lives on the line for us, for our country. And anyway, that's why we're working so hard.
Yeah, and we have a sense of urgency because, this is Hillary again, because we're losing our World War II veterans so quickly, and unfortunately many of them are gone already, so they won't, you know, they're not around to see this tribute. So we'd like to get this completed as quickly as possible.
You know, I made a promise to Violet.
Go ahead.
I made a promise to Violet Cowden, I think is where I started this conversation, and I said, and I received, and I do remember receiving, and I did receive an email from Ann Wood Kelly, who was an American woman who flew for the ATA, and in our correspondence, there was one very heartfelt one, and she said, they have forgotten about us. And I can only tell you it means everything to them, to those of us who care about these women, who care about the military, who care about our veterans, to tell this story.
And it's a fascinating story, and it's an absolutely unbelievable story in terms of that as well. And the archival footage and the photos that you've gathered for this to be able to tell the story as well is absolutely spectacular. I was able to watch the trailer again before we went on the air, and I highly recommend anybody go to the Facebook, the Fly Girls Facebook page, and to be able to watch the trailer of what's going to be a very tremendous miniseries as well. And like they're saying that they're raising funds in order to get this thing, their story told as well. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Sure. This is Hillary jumping on as the producer. I'll talk about the fundraising. We have a great robust campaign going right now on Fundreamer, which also has a female CEO who took an interest in this project when she met Mattia at a DGA event. That's the Directors Guild of America. And so she asked if she could help us and have our campaign on her site. So we're on Fundreamer, and we have over 180 contributors, which is a testament to our fans and the numbers of people that want to see this. And we are doing great. We have about $17,000 raised so far, and the funds will go towards hiring a writing team for the pilot, as well as some of our startup production costs. And it's really important. We will pursue also traditional investment opportunities as far as, you know, how film, you know, fundraising for film and television are structured. But it's important to start this way because we need to prove to investors that we have an audience, and we need to prove to the studios and to the networks that we have an audience. And we need to show that, you know, we're capable of producing this. So,
and there is right now, if you're aware, in Hollywood, there is a whole effort to get more women directing, more women behind the camera, more women in front of the camera. So it seems that this story is so timely and so needed that we are making an all-out effort push to make that happen.
And it's important that it comes from our voices. It's important that it's a female-driven project. You know, a lot of people have said to us, oh, why don't you thank Steven Spielberg? And, you know, not only does that sort of, you know, belittle Mattia's talents and her research, but, you know, it's time, it's important that this story is told through women's eyes, through female writers and female director and female producers. It's really important. It's nothing against men. It's not to say men can't tell a great story about strong women. It's just that, you know, it's really important that we take ownership of this and present it to the public.
I absolutely agree with that. I mean, you know, my movie, I mean, obviously, being a male, I wrote mine, but I had some really talented females in mine. But, you know, I think that, you know, it gives a better opportunity for a lot of you to be able to have your own, you know, point of view in terms of what happened as well. And I think it's a really great opportunity for a lot of females to get involved into something that was really truly a piece of American history that was almost lost. In the history books, but I think we're at a good time at which that, you know, those history books are being rewritten. The more stories are being told about some of these unsung heroes that were a part of different historical events. And I know it's hard for me to say that there won't be an audience for this, especially considering a lot of the aspects of World War II that haven't been covered yet. I mean, there's quite a few that haven't been, and this one's probably one of the more interesting as well. And a lot of these, like I said, there's been a movement as of late to be able to tell some of these women's stories about their struggles and to be able to conquer a goal that nobody thought they could do that. So, I mean, it's very interesting to say at least we're in a really interesting time right now. And I really hope that you get all the funding you can. I mean, I contributed, and I'm really looking forward to seeing the pilot.
Thank you.
So, yeah, and please, you know, like I said, go to the Fly Girls on Facebook or at Fly Girls Series on Twitter. And I believe it's Fly Girls Series.
Yeah,
is that correct.
At Fly Girls Series is our Twitter handle, and our Facebook page is also facebook.com/Fly Girls Series. And we have wonderful stories on our Facebook page of not only the women who served during this time, but we also have women in the military who are recent veterans who've reached out to us with their stories. And we have some wonderful photos of women, you know, serving now in our current time. So it's great to have that juxtaposition of both past and present.
Yeah,
and
I mean,
also,
it's unbelievable. Go ahead.
I just wanted to say that what we also do is we do post usually on Fridays the men behind the women, because it's important for us to remember the men who helped make it possible for the women to do what they wanted to do. Someone like H. Hap Arnold, and I think it's important to know that it's inclusive of men and women. We're not trying to, you know, just put a light or shine a light just on one particular group of people. More, it's like a time in history. And we know that there have been many, 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 maybe thousands of or hundreds and hundreds of movies made about World War II, and maybe less than a handful that deal with women's roles during the war. I just wanted to point that out.
And our series will be so wonderful for all of our great female actresses of our time right now. If you think of some of the iconic World War II movies with all of these incredible male actors, our series will be like that for our great women actresses of today.
Yeah, I mean, over the past decade, we haven't seen we've seen a little bit more women in pilot roles in terms of movies and television shows as well. And actually, I can only think of one movie at the top of my head, and that was the one I mentioned to you guys during a Twitter chat. I think it was 1945. There was one movie that had a female pilot in it. During World War II. So I'm really hoping that does, you know, kind of tempt some of these actresses to consider doing a fictional, well, not a fictional account, but an actual movie about what's going on too. So hopefully it will inspire a little bit like Band of Brothers did with Steven Spielberg. So fingers crossed that that ends up happening with you guys as well, because I could imagine as so many actresses that would absolutely love to have that, be able to have that role, to be able to tell these stories about these ladies as well. So I'd be very interested to see if that ends up happening as well. Anything else that we're missing? Anything else you ladies want to add?
No, I think we covered a lot. I just think it's just important to know that the time is now, and if they consider helping us and being part of this groundswell, and creating what we know will be some of the best television in a very long time, especially about women.
And I will say, this is Hillary again, that if anybody would like to donate any amount, whether it's a dollar or $5, in honor of a veteran or a person that is currently serving, a family member or friend currently serving right now, if they want to donate and put their names in, then in our series credits, we will have a special, after special thanks, we'll have a section where we'll honor all of the veterans and servicemen and servicewomen, people who donated in their name.
And that's absolutely great. It's a really great tribute to those that have served as well. So it's great to be able to have that portion as well. And I highly recommend anybody go and contribute to this. Like I said, it's going to be, I think that there's a huge audience for this, and I really look forward to that point to be able to watch the pilot when you guys get that all done as well. But it's been an absolute pleasure being able to talk to you ladies about the project. Best of luck to you. Hopefully we'll get you back on. Hopefully when we get a platform for your series as well. And best of luck to you. Hopefully we get that money raised on enough money raised to be able to get this project to a whole new level.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you so much for giving us the time to talk about it.
Thank you, Mark. And we'll update you on our progress.
We'll do. And, I always follow you guys on Twitter as well, especially with the Artemis Film Festival, who's been very huge contributors to helping you guys fundraise as well. And that's how I found out about you. So shout out to them for being able to help out. So, hopefully we'll be able to see it. Are you there?
Yes, we're here.
Oh, okay, I thought I lost you for a second. And I hopefully maybe we'll get the pilot done by the Artemis Film Festival, and I know my movie I think is kind of up for they really want my movie over there too, so maybe we'll be able to meet in person over there and we'll kind of get an update from there. So fingers crossed on that.
Okay, sounds great.
Thank you.
Thank you, ladies, and best of luck to you.
Thank you. Take care. Bye bye.
You too. Bye. That was Hillary and Mattia, Fly Girls series on Facebook and at Fly Girls series on Twitter. I think it's an absolute fabulous story to be able to talk to tell. Please contribute, and I'm expecting next year they'll get a contract, and I really hope like somebody like History Channel or Discovery have the opportunity to get the rights to this and to be able to air it on national television. We've seen so many series about the Muskegee Airmen and a bunch of other things as well, but this aspect I think is going to be very interesting for anybody to be able to do. So fingers crossed that they end up getting a really good platform for this. So hopefully this will happen really, really soon. Anyway, so we have we have a little more time left. I was supposed to have another guest on, but they canceled out at the last minute. So with that in mind, there is something that I needed to do. For the past couple weeks, I've been mentioning that I wanted to do a throwback Thursday. Well, we're going to throwback Wednesday today. We have a interview with Chef Carrie Simon. Carrie Simon was one of my guests in the first year of this show, which was 8 years ago, was when we did our first show. And that year we had that first couple months we had Carrie Simon on. Like I said, Carrie has actually owned several restaurants in the Vegas area. And I think you still have a couple around. I think the one in Mandalay Bay he still has. He passed away. He had a illness called, let me see if I can find here, multiple system atrophy. And the thing with Carrie Simon was, he was kind of the first, rock and roll celebrity chef. He did so many things with a lot of his restaurants as well. Some were successes, some of them, failed. But with that in mind, I mean, he's stung strong. He was an Iron Chef. He was very known throughout the foodie community. He was there in the early days of Food Network. So he's kind of one of those people that is a mainstay at that point. And he was a mainstay here in Vegas just because there's so many other things that were going on. So he had several restaurants here in town. So with that in mind, I wanted to play you guys my interview with Carrie Simon. And I actually got this interview about a week or two after Thanksgiving, I believe. It was great to be able to talk to him a little bit about about what was going on in terms of his restaurants and maybe get some cooking tips and everything as well. So with that in mind, here's our interview from 8 years ago with Chef Carrie Simon. Really great guy. Sorry to say we've lost him this past month, but here's our interview with Carrie Simon.
And how do you like Vegas overall? Do you think that the definitely it's a different kind of world out here, especially with a lot of restaurants and these hotels serving different kinds of food?
I mean, there's no other place like it in the United States. There's so many. I mean, every chef you can imagine is in Vegas. So, you know, I mean, as far as entertainment value and shows and it's all there, you know. I mean, it's a small town, which works for me, where you can go snowboarding at Lee Canyon if you want, mountain biking, go to Red Rock hiking. I mean, there's a lot to be said for Las Vegas. It's a beautiful place, you know, and it's a fast-growing community. And, you know, it's just, I don't know, when I came, like, in 97, and I made it my home, you know, and I've been all over the world, so I don't know what that means, but it must mean something.
Yep. Dr. Anonymous from the chat room has just asked, how often are you on the road from the East Coast, West Coast, Vegas, and basically the world?
I've been traveling a lot this year. Hopefully it'll calm down a little bit because it's been, you know, it's not easy to travel these days. So I'm on the road a lot. I don't really know. I should probably be interesting to kind of like draw out a graph to see what that is. But, you know, I was in Vegas a lot for the Hard Rock, and that was my first baby. So I really took a lot of interest in it. My brother, Scott, was the chef at the restaurant. And now I'm going to be going back and forth for the tastings at Cat House and between L.A. It'll be, you know, that's kind of the deal now, you know.
Do you consider L.A. your home, basically?
No. I mean, I consider, like, I have two homes almost, you know. I live in two different places. So, I have Vegas is where I have home, and also, you know, it's both of them feel comfortable to me.
And yeah, would you ever consider opening a restaurant in your native Chicago?
Oh yeah. I mean, I love Chicago. I always think about going back there. Yeah. No question about it.
Another question from the chat room from Olivia. Have you ever met Gordon Ramsay? And what do you think of him?
Yeah, he came in. I met him a couple of times. Once when I was doing a project in London, way before he was as super famous as he is now. And then another time they shot a segment here for his show. And he's got quite a background. He's got a lot of restaurants. He's done really well for himself. He's really grasped the market, and he's created a niche for himself that people love. I mean, I have a lot of respect for him. You know, that's what the deal is. It's kind of like, you know, trying to figure out what's out there that you can do and being creative with it. So good for him, you know.
Have you caught his new show?
Have I what?
Have you caught his new show, Kitchen Nightmares?
Yeah, I have. Actually, I saw it. He used to have it in, it was a British version of it. I'd seen it before, and then I saw the new one. And, that's a fun show, too, you know. I mean, it's, you know, it's an interesting story each time.
Yeah, especially considering these, a lot of these are new owners. Is there any recommendations you would give if somebody ever wanted to open up a restaurant?
Just make sure you have the right people, you know, and that they have the right experience, and don't take it lightly. You know, there's a lot of young people out there that just, that's what they want to do. They want to be in the restaurant business, but, you know, it's not just like, hey, let's get a key and open up the doors and go start cooking. You know, there's a lot of hidden things that go on, and costs, and, you know, organizing, and, you know, everything from how the valet takes the car to the way the customer gets the plate. It's, there's a lot to it. So I know, like, you know, I get a lot of kids out of school, and that's the first thing, yeah, I want to have my own restaurant. It's like, well, maybe you should, you know, you got to go through the issues here, which are like learning how to peel an onion and then a potato and then cooking a steak. And, you know, there's a lot to it.
And how long has the planning been going on for like the Luxor or the Palms?
The Palms probably been going on for over a year. Luxor, same thing. Takes about, you know, like the design and everything. And I mean, it's, you know, it's kind of, it's like you, I'm always like searching for new ideas and the right silverware, the right plates, the right look of the room, design of the uniforms. It's, it can keep you going for a long time, you know, so you just want to make sure you get all that groundwork accomplished before you open, because once it's done, it's, you've got to go.
And yeah, you consider, trying to think, and you obviously go, you're a world traveler, you just been to China and Japan. Do you see a lot of a lot of different trends over there in Japan, especially considering how popular Iron Chef was over there?
Yeah, you know, it's funny, Japan has a lot of the great chefs of the world over there, you know, a lot of the three-star chefs and a lot of other chefs that are from the from the U.S. have done projects there. So they really embrace cuisine as a global thing. And I think that they're very open-minded to it and like to explore it on a regular basis.
And you're obviously still learning, and you still learn from a lot of cuisines, like Japanese cuisine, a lot of the Korean cuisines, Chinese cuisine. Do you absorb a lot more information? Do you read a lot more cookbooks to kind of get us some ideas to think of new dishes?
You know, I read constantly. I try and read everything I can get my hands on, too. I try and, like, absorb as much as I can and see as much as I can, but you know, when it comes to the end of the day, you know, I try and keep things real, and it's about products and, you know, simplicity and the flavors of what you're serving and really being forward with that, you know. And it's like people don't want food that's been handled a lot. They don't want any tricks, you know, and I am chemical-free and that kind of thing. So, you know, it's like, for me, it's just it's like an extension of who I am, you know. It's not, no, I try not to use any fats, butters, and creams, but I mean, I'm not saying that I don't completely, but I try to avoid it as much as possible.
And how long have you kind of been into the whole green, the kind of green cooking kind of thing?
Well, I don't know, maybe longer than it's probably been going on, because I've always been interested in organic products, but I've always kind of eaten like raw foods since I was, like, as long as I can remember. I've always loved raw broccoli and cauliflowers and salads made of those things. And I've always loved, you know, I mean, one of the things we learn when we're growing up cooking is like about how important the product is. So you start to learn about different companies and different, you know, I grew up partly in the Northwest too, in Seattle area. So, you know, you get fresh salmons and a lot of different seafoods, and it's, you learn when you eat like that, that it's like nothing else can replace it. So I don't know if all of a sudden one day, since all this kind of like trend has been going to go in that direction, if it was a new thing for me or if it had just been part of my life, you know.
And I have another question for the chat room. Are you married?
No, I'm not married.
Seeing anybody, or just
now we're getting personal.
Okay, good. I mean, how do you go around not using like fats or butters or creams? Do you use a lot more spices in that?
I use olive oils. You know, I try and use oils that are absorbed by the body a little differently, and that are healthier for you. I mean, I like using olive oils. I like the flavors of olive oil. So that's a simple one for me.
So yeah. So anything else to announce? Any other news that we can put out to my listeners?
No, I mean, we got the Palms. We got to make sure that the Simon at Palms Place is going to be very exciting. We got Luxor opening soon, but other than that, What's that?
Any date on the Luxor?
Around New Year's.
Around New Year's.
Yeah, around New Year's Eve. So, woohoo!
Yeah. So, so you're looking forward to maybe after this, maybe opening up a few more restaurants around the states or maybe internationally.
We have some conversations going with other projects right now. So who knows what's going to happen?
Well, feel free to give us a ring and let us know what's going on with the. Going on with your restaurants. We appreciate you coming on, Terry. Remember, his restaurants are at the Luxor is going to be opening up at New Year's and
yep.
Palms in March.
Yeah.
And then you have Simon's LA, and then you also have one in San Francisco.
Right on.
Okay.
Don't forget Spotlight Live in New York City.
Spotlight Live in New York City.
Yep.
And you can get. You can get your stuff at hsn.com, right?
Yeah.
Your cookware.
Yeah.
And you can always, I believe there's a, you guys have a website for your restaurant in LA, right?
Yeah. You just go to Simon LA.
Okay.
Or you can go to carriesimon.com, and I think there's a link there to it.
Okay, then. Well, we thank you for coming on the show, Kerry. I wish you the best of luck for launching those two restaurants, and we'll definitely get the word out.
Great. Thanks for everything.
Yeah, thanks a lot, Kerry.
You're welcome. Anytime.
Yeah.
Bye. Thank
you. Bye.
That was Kerry Simon. Like I said, that was from you know, a long time ago. That was from 8 years ago. He had passed away on September the 11th of this year, and I was sorry to see he went at such a young age, and he was very still successful as well. KGB over over at Mandalay Bay. KGB over at Mandalay Bay, and then of course Simon's Kitchen over at the Hard Rock. They're still in operation right now, and you can still taste some of his very award-winning recipes there as well. So. Like I said, he's gone too soon, and we're going to miss Kerry. But I figured I would do our interview, and he was very, very insightful. So it was great to be able to hear his voice once again. Coming up next week, we do have our guests. We're going to have guests for the next 2 weeks. We're going to do these mega shows every Wednesday now. For the foreseeable future, because we've been getting a lot of requests as of late. Let me get to my page real quick, and I will tell you who we're going to have on next week, and then we'll have somebody else on as well. Let me see if I can get down here. We are going to have, let's see here, go to page 2. There we go. We're going to have actor and filmmaker Steve Nagier will be on with us, and we'll be talking about his current project, The Last King. Really great guy to be able to talk to you later as well. And in a week, 2 weeks from today, we're going to have Donica Knight on. Really great singer who's open for the likes of Kid Rock, Luke Bryan, and the band Perry. We're going to have her on in 2 weeks. And then we'll have another guest who I'm trying to confirm for next week, and then another guest for next week. So we'll be doing 2 guests a week for this foreseeable future until probably the new year. Because we've been catching up on some of the guests that we've wanted on for a while now. So you'll catch us at 1 p.m. Pacific now on Wednesdays. It's been a little bit more convenient for me to do these Wednesday mega shows now. So we'll have 2 guests every day for the next foreseeable future. Anyway, with that being said, we'll see you guys next week with Steve Nagier, actor and filmmaker. It'll be interesting to be able to talk to him a little bit about soccer as well. He's a former soccer player as well. Please check us out, VegasPodcasting.com. I'll make sure to update that site sometime this week. Also, Somewhere in Vegas on Facebook and at SWIV on Twitter, at SWIV. You guys can check us there as well. Absolutely great to be able to be back in the swing of things, as it were. Like I said, we'll be doing these Wednesday mega shows for the next couple of weeks. Hopefully it'll be very interesting, because we've got a lot of interesting guests coming up in terms of as well. And I need to do my Miss Rodeo guest as well. Maybe we'll do that again this year. We always do it every year, and it's been an 8-year tradition, a 7-year tradition, so we'll do that as well. With that being said, we'll see you guys next week, 1 p.m. Pacific, 4 p.m. Eastern on Wednesday.